Welcome, everyone. I will call the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee to order. And as those of you hardcore people who come here every time can tell, we've had a lot of changes in our committee. Senator Telfer here, to my right, has been promoted to vice chair, and or chair of vice, as we like to call her. And we have a brand new member, Senator Close. And Senator Close represents Senate District 8, correct?
Correct.
So do you want to say a little about your district?
My district is the Albany-Corvallis area, and it's very nice to be able to represent a bigger part of the district I represented when I was in the House. So it's nice to be with you.
And welcome to you, to the committee. It's we modestly refer to ourselves as the Dream Team. And we are a small but mighty group. Senator Haas will be a little late today by previous agreement, but he will be here in time for the joint meeting. So we will start with our first agenda item, which is the core system replacement project update from the Department of Revenues.
Madam Chair, as the committee knows, you've been following the core system replacement project closely. And so the department is here, Director Buchholz and Eric Smith, who have spoken with you before on the issue, are going to update you on where the project is now.
Welcome.
Thank you. Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Jim Buchholz, and I'm the director of your Department of Revenue. And with me today is Eric H. Smith, who is the administrator of our project management office. I'm going to make just some brief opening remarks and then turn it over to Eric for an update on where we are on the system project. As stewards over the revenue streams, the state's revenue streams, we believe that DOR has two critical responsibilities. The first is to work to maintain the short-term revenue streams that we rely on in state government to fund the services that preserve and enhance the quality of life for Oregon citizens. And the second, to that first, I just want to be to make the statement that in the Department of Revenue, we are very aware of our role in state government and how the part that we play in order to make the rest of state government go. We're the fuel that provides the funding for those services. But the second piece that is equally as critical to us is the maintenance of the long-term health of those revenue streams. And so in that regard, we treat and we look at the Department of Revenue and make decisions at the Department of Revenue very much like a business would, you know, a going concern. And part of what a business does is to maintain the continuity of the business through investing in the future. And that's what this system proposal is about for the Department of Revenue, looking to the future and making sure that we're doing what we need to do to maintain the long-term health of those revenue streams. Our responsibility in that is to identify both risks that we see to those revenue streams and identify opportunities and then gather together the information that the decision makers need to be able to make an intelligent decision about whether or not to go forward with that. And the decision makers that I'm talking about here are the governor and the legislative body. And so that's what we're doing here. Our request to upgrade the Department of Revenue systems represents both a mitigation risk strategy and an opportunity. I won't go into either of those or the specific things that we've identified unless you want me to. We've been before you many times before, and we've gone over those. And so in the interest of time, I won't go over those. But just bottom line is that we believe that this will enable us to maintain the continuity of those revenue streams that you rely on. As I said, Eric is our administrator of the project management office, and I'm going to turn it over to him so he can give a status report that will update you on the progress that we've made since September when we last met, and then also talk about a change to our horizon here that has come up recently.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair Burdick, Vice Chair Telfer, and Senator Close. Thank you for bearing with us. I know you saw this yesterday in the other committee that you were in. My name is Eric Smith, and I am the administrator of the Program Management Office for the Department of Revenue. Briefly today, we'll just give you a slight background and then an update on the project status, as Director Buchholz mentioned, and then what our next steps look like. As Jim said, our primary interest in this project that started several years ago is really to just mitigate the risk that we won't be able to maintain our current service levels into the future. We're operating on technology that was founded in the 1980s. And the benefit of the type of work that we're doing and the new technology that's available for us today is that by the nature of our work, we can enhance our opportunity to be more effective and to actually generate additional revenue. The work that we've done since the beginning of the year in executing our business plan was to identify how much it would cost, what we believe, to implement our new system at $69.2 million. It is total implementation cost. Excuse me. Through the implementation and final warranty phase, which would end in December of 2018, we have negotiated contingent to legislative approval a contract with the vendor Fast Enterprises at $34.5 million. That is a fixed capped price. It will not exceed that for the life of the contract. And then we estimate that the state's costs, our costs for implementing the solution would be $34.7 million during that same time frame. And the news that Director Buchholz said I would share about our horizon is that we learned on November 30th that the governor's 13-15 recommended budget does not include funding for the project, and so I'll share in a moment what we think that means for us. A brief status on the project. The business case that we proposed in 2011, we've been successful at executing against that. We acquired the scope, schedule, and cost information to aid the decision makers in the process. One of the things that the department was faced with when we first surfaced this need in 2009 was some difficult funding opportunities. There was no general fund available. The debt limit was not available for financing. And so by the nature of the business we're in, we could look at a benefits-based or performance-based contract. Several other states have done that with their revenue departments. And so that was a large portion of the work that we've been doing over the last few years and in negotiating with the vendor that we're Fast Enterprises was to design what an alternative funding method might look like. And so we were able to accomplish that work. And then, again, negotiating the agreement with FAST, contingent to legislative approval. The agreement does not exist until the legislature approves the project and funds it. And the only reason that we were in the position where we had to sign an agreement was because we couldn't share the details of that, according to our procurement attorneys, unless both parties had agreed to those. And the way we could show we agreed to it was to sign the agreement with the contingencies for approval. A project of this size requires a great deal of documentation. We have over 30 foundational project management and other documents that are guiding us through this project. One of those is our business case, which we refreshed when we presented our budget materials for the governor's recommended budget process. A portion of that business case is an addendum that we've added, which is a total cost of ownership analysis. We looked at a 10-year horizon for what the benefits we think may be and what the total cost of owning a new system may be and what the net benefit to the state would be for a new system compared to maintaining our existing systems or enhancing existing systems, and looking particularly at the commercial off-the-shelf solution that Fast Enterprises has installed in 16 other revenue agencies. And so that work, we've finished the work. We're wrapping up our narrative on the total cost of ownership model, and that'll be available by January. This next slide is on page 5 in the report that we gave to you, and it's really just a timeline of the various activities we've been engaged in over the last year. Not necessarily for you to read in this PowerPoint slide, but the main milestones that we've accomplished, it took us about 6 months to negotiate the agreement with Fast Enterprises. There's a great deal of due diligence that went into that contract. Once we negotiated that this summer, we had to refresh our business case because then we had known, tangible talking points that we could put into our business case about scope, schedule, and cost. And then, as I just mentioned, we worked this fall very hard on our total cost of ownership analysis. And then throughout this time, we've been updating many of those foundational documents as we learn more information about our schedule and the demands that are going to be needed to be met during the project. We refresh those documents to be able to lay out our go-forward plan. So where we are with all the work we've been doing is now with the governor's announcement, we're developing a plan with governor staff, Department of Administrative Services staff, and with legislative staff of what that means for going forward for 2015. Most of the work we've done is going to be very useful for 2015. We're in a much better place today than we were 2 years ago with regard to our understanding of our business processes, our data, the needs we have for the future, the opportunities that are there. And so I think we're in a good place to take this information and develop a very good strategy for going forward to 2015. Are there any questions?
Questions? Senator Telfer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Given the fact that I would imagine that the cost is very labor-intensive, the longer we put this off, what do you see as the trajectory of the cost escalating?
Madam Chair, Senator Telfer, may I ask a qualifying question? The cost overall for the project, the cost for a contract, the cost
$69 million.
$69 million. I'd be speculating to answer that.
Oh, I understand.
It depends on how much additional work will be required of us to demonstrate we're ready. One cost we know, if we have to do a new procurement, we've estimated that to be about $700,000. But much of the work we've done in our project closeout, what we think we'll do is we'll just have it be available for the decision-making process in 2015. We don't anticipate that, excuse me, the landscape will change so drastically that that would be stale information. It's not a large pool of vendors, and we've got a very solid understanding of the products that are available. And so I think we can still establish a very good conversation for 2015 without a lot of additional cost between now and then, but there would be some.
Senator Close.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Eric, is there, and of course I'm new, so you may have presented this earlier, but do you have an itemization of the budget, the $69 million? Is there anything that exists, or will there be something that we'd be able to look at?
Yes, Madam Chair. Senator Close, we can provide for you the narrative that we presented for the governor's office in his recommended budget, which would have that detail,
okay.
And we're happy to provide that. And then if you need more information after that, please let me know.
Go ahead. You're done?
We're done.
All right. Any more questions from the committee? Thank you very much for the update. I don't think this story is over on the budget, so just send that little signal. I know you can't advocate, but others can. All right. What's next here? Now we've got the tax expenditure report. Dr. Warner.
Yes, Madam Chair, it's that time of the biennium where when the governor's budget's released, the tax expenditure report is also released. So we've got two of the folks who have put in a great many hours in putting that together for you, Kyle Easton and Michelle McCown from the Revenue Department research section. And hopefully you've started going through that document.
I've memorized it, actually. It's all committed to memory, but, you know, for the benefit of the others, we'll let you present here. Welcome.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Michelle McCown. I'm with Kyle Easton here. We're both economists with the Oregon Department of Revenue's research section.
If you could speak up
a little bit,
that'd be great.
Paul said we're here to present the tax expenditure report for the 2013-15 biennium to you. I'm going to describe the report a little bit about what it is and why it's produced, and also present some of our suggestions on the best way to use the report and the information contained within it. It contains all 373 of Oregon's tax expenditures, and there's quite a lot of information. It's whether you're like us and we've been staring at it for months, or someone who's it's their first flick through the book, or anywhere in between. It's just the nature of the material. It's very easy to get lost, and you see less of the proverbial forest and end up sort of staring at the bark of tree trunks. So, what we want to do is try to present some information that helps you to approach the material that's most useful and efficient for the policymaking process. So part of the discussion is going to be the mechanics of the report, which is necessary. It's useful to understand how it's put together, but we'll also include pepper it with some more conceptual theoretical discussion of how to frame the tax expenditures and to help with understanding with them. After taking a tour of the report, Kyle's going to start talking about the numbers. He's going to share with you how the revenue impact estimates are constructed and also present some of the nuances that are important in keeping in mind when you're interpreting the figures that are included in the book. And then we're going to conclude the presentation with we've added something that's it's not actually part of the book. It's new this year, where we've made an attempt to group the tax expenditures by policy categories. And so he's going to talk more about that. But, again, it's a useful tool with the goal of, providing the information in the most efficient way for your policy work. So,
I think we're just going to go off the website. That's okay.
They have the slides, right? So.
Yes.
This is a trial run.
Yeah. A little bit. Oh, there we go.
I don't know how to get it larger, but.
Okay, great. So we'll begin with what is a tax expenditure. And there's several ways that Oregon is set apart from other states and that we're strong in are the way that we report and provide information on tax expenditures. One way is that we have a statutory definition to work from. Not all states have this. So this is direct from statute paraphrasing. Basically, the tax expenditure results from any law of the state or the federal government which causes a departure from the normal tax base. Here it's established taxes, but it's basically what is considered your normal tax base, and the expenditure departs from that, where you're giving certain groups of taxpayers special treatment. And you can see there's a specific definition, but it's also quite broad. It's very comprehensive. In Oregon, we have 15 tax programs, such as income tax, property tax, weight mile tax, all the various programs that have tax expenditures. And so what we've done in this book is each program has a chapter, and there's a little bit of information about what the program is. And in that, you'll also find what we're considering the normal tax base, because there's different interpretations of it. So we want to be clear that this is what we're working from as the base, and this is what the expenditures are departing from. So in terms of, if you look at the 15 tax programs in terms of total expected program revenue, well over 90% is in the income tax and the property tax programs, which is not surprisingly. And in terms of the book, when you look in the book and you see income tax, just keep in mind that we're talking about personal income tax and corporate income tax. They're rolled up into one category. And when we talk about corporate income tax, we're talking about the excise tax and the income tax rolled up, for simplicity's sake. So for the property tax program, the normal tax base, you'll find this in the chapter, but just they're the two largest ones. It's worth just talking about this here. The normal tax base for the property tax program is all property is taxed. So the expenditures reflect any property that's exempt, either fully exempt, partially exempt, or it's assessed in a way that's different than what a similar property would normally be assessed. The normal tax base for the income tax programs ties to the federal definition. And so all sources of income are taxable, although for the business income, the taxable income is the business income less any of the expenses incurred to generate that business income. So, and it's worth pointing out, so not all like deductions automatically become a tax expenditure. Like we don't have a cost of labor expenditure or office supplies expenditure. It's like that's already rolled up into the tax base. And then the expenditures depart from that. So, and Another implication of that definition that we're using the federal definition is if the federal government has any laws that are imparting special treatment to taxpayers, Oregon does as well. So out of 373 expenditures, 115 result from the federal expenditures carrying through to Oregon. And it is possible that Oregon can disconnect from those, but generally we tie to the federal definition. So now, that's the mechanical side of it. Now we're going to step into a little bit more of the conceptual side. So this is more just like stepping back, and when you're looking at the tax expenditures, a way to view them. There's four categories of types of tax expenditures. The first would be an expenditure that provides economic incentives to encourage specific taxpayer behavior. And an example of this, which we're going to use as our example to step through one tax expenditure and show you the information that we provide for all of them. We're going to use the Rural Medical Practice Credit, which provides an incentive for physicians and other health professionals to practice in rural areas of the state. So that's an example of the first kind of tax expenditure. The second is one where you provide financial assistance to certain groups of taxpayers. An example would be the Severe Disability Credit, which allows an additional personal exemption for taxpayers with severe disabilities. And these first two, when you're thinking about comparing it with budget spending line items with the tax expenditure, which is part of your tax system, these are the two kinds of categories that are the most alike that you would consider, like which is the best way to approach this policy goal. There's two more categories of tax expenditures. The third is prohibited by federal law, which is simply we can't tax this. So that becomes an expenditure. And then the fourth is, we classify here as simplifying or reducing the cost of tax administration, which could mean for the Department of Revenue, for the state, for the taxpayer, just in general. And examples of this would include like personal property for personal use, the compliance and reporting requirements for the taxpayer and the tax agency if we were to go out and try to assess all personal property. So that's a tax expenditure. We don't tax that. Another example is business inventory. Again, similarly, the compliance and the reporting requirements for the businesses, as well as this one would also create an incentive for firms to move their inventory out of the state on January 1st for assessment and then move them back in after the assessment is complete. So it would create a distortion in the business practices. So the decision was made is we're not going to tax business inventory. So that's part of this tax administration category. So that's just a way to frame it. Like I said, the book is not organized in that way. We didn't make an attempt to funnel them into these categories, but it's a useful way to sort of have that in your mind when you're making policy decisions. So now back to the mechanics. We're going to go talk about what. So this report, it's required by the 1995 Budget Accountability Act, which states that tax expenditures are similar to direct expenditures, and it says that the report will allow tax expenditures to be debated in conjunction with online budgets. The full statute is in Appendix A of the report. So, and one of the requirements of the statute is that we organize a report by budget area. So it's organized that way, and just it's not the new 10-year budget plan. We've kept consistent with the existing budget categories like natural resources, transportation, all of that, the way it has been in the past. So there's three sorts in the report. When you're looking at it, the first sort is by tax program. So you have the income tax, property tax, and so on. Then within that, the type, if it's a federal exclusion, Oregon subtraction, you know, what kind of tax type it is. And then the third is by the budget category. And then like I mentioned, at the end of this presentation, Carl's going to be presenting another way to group the expenditures by policy area. That's not part of the book. That's not part of what was required by statute. That's sort of just another tool, he'll explain more later. So now that we have an overview of the report, and don't worry, I'm not going to ask you to read this. We'll zoom in on this, on the pieces of this, but I just want you to see the overall layout. Each of the expenditures has a consistent format, and the format is designed to follow all of the requirements in the statute. So we'll go ahead and step through those now. One, like I mentioned, it's organized by budget, program, or function, and we use a numbering convention to do that. Another requirement is that we identify the statutory authority. In most cases, there's one statutory authority. In this case, there's three. And I just want to point out, when you see the statutes, that's only related to the authority for the expenditure. It's not every statute related to the provision or the program. So this is not intended as an encyclopedia of statutory references. This is just related to the expenditure. And within the description, sometimes you'll see statutory references related to a specific narrative, but again, it's not comprehensive for the whole program. We're also required to present revenue loss estimates for the current and the subsequent biennial, which Kyle's going to talk more about the numbers after I finish this. And you'll see, like I mentioned, when we're talking income tax, we've got the corporate and the personal. The revenue impact estimates are broken out between the corporate and the personal. Some of them apply just to the corporations, some apply just to personal income tax, and some do apply to both. And for each, we have information on sunsets, and a description just describes the provision. We're also required to create a purpose statement, and it can be a little trickier than you might imagine, actually. There's only about 9% of the expenditures have an explicit purpose statement in the statute. And when that's the case, that's always our first choice. We will take it directly from statute. But in most cases, we have to create an implicit purpose statement. And so we utilize a number of sources. There's legislative committee discussion notes, legislative staff summary documents, other statutory language. And when you see the word presumably, that's sort of your clue. Presumably, we've gathered some information and put the best statement together that we could. Another implicit statement are the ones to comply with federal law. Those are pretty self-explanatory, but that's also an implicit statement. It's not specifically in the Oregon statute. And I should point out that the purpose statements are very important in terms of the evaluations, and that's another element that sets Oregon apart from other states, is that we attempt to have a methodical evaluation of the expenditures, and that is part of the report. It's also extended in the tax credit committee and the sunsetting schedule and all that. So all of those pieces are what gives Oregon strength in this area. We're required to provide information about who benefits from the tax expenditure. And so for each of the expenditures, we have text. We do some narrative. I should point out that for this report, obviously, this is a massive report. It's a very collaborative process. So we work with many agencies. Many people have contributed. And this is one area where we get a lot of information from the agencies about their program, who's benefiting, talk to them about that. And, of course, we use our own the tax return data as well. When we have personal income tax data available and that it wouldn't violate any of our disclosure requirements, we also present distributional information, as you'll see here. And for the sunsetting credits, we had an expanded packet. There's quite an extensive packet of distributional information that's already been distributed related to the sunsetting credits. But for the purposes of this book, we have this standardized table. One thing we added this year is the graphical representation on the right, so you can clearly see, you know, where the distribution is falling in terms of income categories. It's divided into five quintiles, and you can see the number of filers who are claiming the credit, the average revenue impact of the credit, and the percentage of the revenue impact by income group. Like I mentioned, we're required to include an evaluation. And we ask agencies to do the evaluation based on their subject matter expertise or, you know, their role in administering the program. And we provide some guidance, some materials for them to use. But it's really their evaluation. You know, it's up to them to create it the way that they feel is best. The statutory direction is that they answer two questions. Does the tax expenditure accomplish its purpose? And is it the most fiscally effective means of accomplishing the purpose? There's not all of the expenditures are evaluated. There's a number of reasons why not. Then they're specified in the program, such as if the revenue impact is less than $100,000, if the federal law prohibits taxation, and so on. So you'll see that in the book. So that wraps up the tour of the book, and if there's no questions, then we're ready to move on and start talking about the numbers.
Okay, please do. The numbers is what is really the bottom line here.
Okay, thanks, Michelle. For the record, Kyle Easton, economist with the Oregon Department of Revenue in the research section. And as Michelle said, I'm going to give a brief overview or a background, if you will, on some of the revenue impact estimates contained within the report, and then also finish with a little background on a new tool that we have available or will be available on our website later this week related to the categorization of tax expenditures. So hopefully you'll find that helpful as well. It's kind of small. But as to the revenue estimates, Michelle mentioned this, we're required to give estimates related to the current biennium and the upcoming one. So you'll see estimates throughout the report related to the 11-13 and the 13-15 bienniums. And what we're looking at here, the slide that I have up, is a high-level overview. So this is one of the first exhibits you'll see in the report. But it's an overview of all the tax expenditures by tax program and then also expenditure type. So it starts off with the income tax. And this is both the personal and corporate income taxes, Michelle discussed earlier. And what we can see here is we have a column for estimated revenues, and that's at a comes from the Office of Economic Analysis as part of their quarterly revenue forecast, and they're putting the figure at about $14.5 billion in estimated revenues for 13-15. And we can compare that to for the revenue impacts of the tax expenditures for the same time period, the 13-15 biennium, of about $12.5 billion. And we also, and I apologize for the size of the font up there, but one thing to keep in mind is down here we have a listing of the expenditures by the expenditure type. So the first two rows there are federal exclusions, adjustments, and deductions, and those are the ones we term federal connects because those exist due to Oregon's tie to federal taxable income. And what I want to highlight in this case is the federal connect tax expenditures account for about 70% of the total tax expenditure revenue loss for all of the personal and corporate income tax expenditures. A little bit further down on the property tax side, we see we're expecting about $10.7 billion in estimated revenues in 13-15, and you can compare that to about $23.5 billion in estimated loss through the tax expenditures. And that's due a little bit to the concentration and the overall setup of the property tax system, which I'll touch on here in a little bit. But also, keeping with the table here, within the report, we have chapters for other some of the other tax programs. So the weight mile tax is included, cigarette and other tobacco. And then in the other state tax that you see here are some of the smaller ones that are maybe not as mainstream, but they include like the emergency 911 tax, the school construction tax. And the idea here is any revenue program or any tax program that contains a tax expenditure is contained within this report. So we do have it detailed within the tax expenditure report. Let's see if I can go to the next one here. So what I want to discuss now is a little bit of the concentration related to some of the larger tax expenditures for both the income and the property tax programs. So what you have in front of you here is revenue impact estimates for the top 10 income tax expenditures. So this is both corporate and personal income tax expenditures combined. And the ones you see up there that are shaded in blue, those are Oregon-specific expenditures, where the ones that are not shaded in blue, those are your the ones we term federal connect ones. But you can see just by scanning through there that about of the top 10 tax expenditures, about 66% of the overall revenue loss is contained in these top 10 tax expenditures, the largest of them being ones at the federal level, which are the home mortgage interest deduction, employer-paid medical benefits, and pension contributions and earnings. But the point that I wanted to make here is just when you're looking at the overall figures, keep in mind that there are some expenditures that are rather large and account for a lot of that overall figure. On the property tax side, this concentration is much greater. Remember, we saw there was about a 2-to-1 ratio almost of estimated revenue loss compared to the actual revenue yield from the property tax system. And a lot of that is due to just the largest tax expenditure on the property tax side, which is for intangible personal property. And you can think most of this is going to be in financial accounts, savings accounts, 401ks, things of that nature. But then rounding out kind of the top three of these large ones is the expenditure for state and local property and also for federal property. And, Michelle, you mentioned this a little bit earlier, but the federal property is a little unique in that we're prohibited by federal law in taxing these. So even if you wanted to, without some act at the federal level, for the most part, you wouldn't be able to see any of that revenue gain. But it really, if you're looking at the overall figures here for the 10 largest tax expenditures, 96% of that revenue loss is contained within these. And of that, 60% is in just one tax expenditure, that large one for intangible personal property. So it really is a high level of concentration in the property tax side. So a few notes that I wanted to bring to your attention regarding the revenue estimates. The first thing is that these estimates are static. They're not dynamic, meaning if there's any downstream effects from these tax expenditures, say from like maybe there's an economic development expenditure that would induce some sort of economic behavior, the revenue estimate will only take into account that initial revenue loss. It wouldn't, if like a firm increases hiring, it wouldn't have those downstream effects of maybe increases on the personal income tax side or something along those lines. Second note is there can be some interactions between expenditures. So an example that I like to use is on the property tax side, if you made a change to, say, the special assessment of forest land, that could cause forest land owners to possibly maybe change their behavior a little bit and qualify under maybe a conservation land tax expenditure or shift into maybe farmland or some other type of category. So if you make one change to one expenditure, that could have subsequent changes to other expenditures as well. And that's one of the reasons why we emphasize that the potential revenue yield is not equal to the estimates contained within this book. So if you're looking at a revenue estimate and you see maybe the loss is estimated at $15 million, if you eliminate that expenditure right then, you wouldn't expect to gain exactly $15 million. And part of that reason is because these interactions between expenditures and also some specific expenditures can be taken over a number of years in some cases. So we see this on the corporate side with some corp credits where if a corporation lacks sufficient tax liability to take a credit in a certain year, they can carry it forward possibly for 5 or 10 years or something along those lines. So if an expenditure expires today, there could be corporations that are taking that for the preceding 5 years, depending on their own situation. Something that's specific to the property tax estimates is that they contain both a loss and a shift. Excuse me. And the shift arises when districts go out for, primarily you'll see this in case of a bond levy, where they go out for a dollar levy rather than a rate levy. So if a district goes out for a dollar amount that they say they want to raise by this bond, rather than there being a revenue loss, there's actually a shift from one property when you exempt it to other properties within that district that are not exempt. So it's a little bit different than just a straight-up revenue loss. And we, within the individual expenditures, we do detail both the loss from an exemption on the property tax side and the shift to other properties. So those are both there. And then one last note is these expenditures are based on current law. So we have a page in the report that we call the sunset page that lists all the tax expenditures that are scheduled to sunset in the 13-15 biennium. And so what we mean by current law is if there is an expenditure scheduled, maybe it's a credit, you're probably very familiar with that, where there's a number of credits that are set to sunset more or less every biennium on a rotating basis. If they're set to expire, the revenue estimate within the report will contain that. So you will see generally, you can see like a large drop-off from maybe the 11-13 revenue estimate to the 13-15, and that'd be due to that expiration in the tax expenditure. And this also holds true for tax expenditures at the federal level, too. So anything we're connected to at the federal level, if they're set to expire, you would see that reflected in the revenue estimates contained within the report. Okay. And then what I want to do lastly is give you a little overview of what's going to be available on our website a little bit later this week. And that is, we came up with a new way to categorize these tax expenditures. And the idea being, there's 373 tax expenditures. The report is over 400 pages. It's a dense document. So getting maybe a high-level view is not too difficult in the report. And then also diving into the specific expenditures, there's tons of great information on those. But being able to look at these things in more bite-sized chunks is somewhat limited in the report and its current organization. So we took a shot at organizing the tax expenditures into specific what we're calling policy categories. And we did this by looking at what some other states have done in their own tax ministers' reports And then we also consulted with Legislative Revenue Office and the Chief Financial Office at TAS as well. And what we came up with and what you'll see online is essentially a listing of 24 policy categories that tax expenditures belong to. And there'll be a listing of the revenue estimates associated with both the individual expenditures and also within these categories. So if, for example, you wanted to take a look at like tax expenditures associated with senior and disabled individuals, you would just click on, there's a little plus on the website here, and it'd open up, well, it's not a PowerPoint, so it doesn't do that. But it would open up this this subtable here, and you would see these are all the expenditures that are associated with senior and disabled individuals. And you'll notice there's a few here that have little stars next to them, and that's to note that those ones exist in multiple categories. So when we were kind of going through this process, there's a number of tax expenditures that could fall both in one category as well as another. They don't fit nicely just into one single category. So rather than trying to just place them in one and not another, we decided we'd rather have them in both. So that way, if, for example, you're looking at the additional medical deduction for the elderly, it would make sense to see that in the senior and disabled category, but you'd also probably want to see that in a healthcare category. And so that's why we've noted it with a little star there, that it does exist in multiple categories. And that is one reason to be careful if you're ever going to kind of use a summary, a summed figure for these ones, because you will be double counting tax expenditures because they do exist in multiple categories. So you want to be careful. The totals on the previous slide that we saw won't match some of the totals within our report because of that double counting. But there's also there's a number of other categories. The senior and disabled I thought was kind of one that's more of a mainstream one. But one of the benefits of having all these 24 categories is there's some of the smaller ones that maybe you wouldn't think of without kind of reading through this report a number of times. So an example, one of those is the retirement category, which details the expenditures related to retirement savings or inducing some sort of retirement savings by individuals. But a note I would make on these categories is this was really our first attempt at this. We did look at some other best practices, but it is somewhat of a subjective topic on where to place these tax expenditures. Do they exist in healthcare? Do they exist in economic development, energy, and so on? So this is really our first shot. We would definitely welcome feedback from you all as you're working through this on ways that we could possibly make this more helpful for you in your work. And like I was saying, that will be available on our website a little bit later this week. The tax expenditure report is already up there and is available as a PDF for your use. And with that, that kind of concludes our background of the tax expenditure report, and we'd be happy to address any questions that we can.
Thank you. This is a useful report. This type of analysis is really what led to our decision to create automatic sunsets for the tax credits. And, of course, there's a whole level of tax expenditures that are not in the credit category, and there's a continuing discussion on how to get a more organized handle on some of those exemptions and deductions as well as the tax credits. But thank you for the report. Senator Telfer, did you have?
I have a question of Kyle. You asked for other lists or what might be helpful. You know, a lot of these tax expenditures are actually just deferrals. For instance, the contribution for retirement. You don't claim that income until you start taking it out. So it's really just deferring the income tax on those. Is there a way to discern which ones are really actually just deferrals and then try to do some sort of analysis on what's the time horizon on actually recognizing those tax receipts?
Madam Chair, Senator Telfer, there's plenty of information in our description of the tax expenditure, so it would be detailed of which ones are fitting kind of your description there. I can't think of some way that's contained in the report, at least, where you could tease out those figures. We don't have them reported in the way you mentioned, where it's like this is the amount that is kind of the deferral, and this is the amount that's now being claimed, and how those are balancing out. That information wouldn't be contained in the report, but we could certainly put something like that together or available.
In addition to obvious question, some of it was because as we do revenue projections and things like that, I mean, little things will change that time period on the deferral. For instance, we may have thought we were going to get more retirement income because people were retiring and actually receiving their income. In fact, that has not happened. A lot of people are staying in the job market, and so they've deferred that for even a few more years, which kind of skews certain pieces of revenue projections. And that's just one example of the deferment of income tax versus the actual outright exclusion of not ever receiving it. So it would be interesting to look and see if there's a way to glean what all the deferred expenditures are or that are merely deferring the income tax, and then try to do some sort of analysis on trying to figure out when, in fact, those dollars will be recognized at the state level.
That's a good point. Yeah. Other questions? Thank you for your presentation. Okay, property tax. Are we prepared on property tax? Do we have all the usual suspects here? It looks like we do. if you want to delay till your time, certain we can. Yeah. But it looks like you're all here.
No, I think Madam Chair, I'll ask Christine. She's got some kind of background information to go over with the committee, and then we have our panel. Ready after that.
All right. Thank you, Christine. You're on.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, just wanted to go over a little bit of the latest information available on compression and what real market values have been doing in the property tax arena. We've got some, they're not finalized yet, but some preliminary numbers back from the Department of Revenue on what the compression loss looks like for this this tax year. This will be the assessed values in as of January 1st, 2012, driving this. And the real market values must have declined a little bit because the compression losses have been steadily increased. In Clackamas County, they've gone from 2.1% to 2.9%, Multnomah 6.7% to 8.3%, and Deschutes is up a little bit from 1.2% to 1.5%, and Lane is up 1%. And this is the percent of the imposed taxes lost due to compression. Also, changed property ratios have been impacted by these declines in real market values as well. There's an across-the-board increase in the changed property ratio, and this means that real market value has declined relative to assessed value on average. There have been talk of reform before. Property tax reform proposals came from the 2009 Task Force on Comprehensive Revenue Restructuring. Included a menu of ideas, all listed there on your sheet. You can see they included a reset of the property tax assessed value to real market value at the time of sale. That that concept is also as a legislative concept in this upcoming session. There was a recommendation to set a ceiling or a floor to the changed property ratio. That concept's also on the list for this upcoming session. Recommendations from that task force include attaching assessed value growth to inflation, allowing a one-time change in permanent rates to facilitate the transition to lower federal timber payments or other needs for additional revenue, so allow that flexibility there. Another recommendation would be to repeal Measure 50 and make Measure 5 rates lower. We haven't seen that one come up in the list this time around. could also reduce local property taxes and out-of-state property tax and distribute a portion of the income tax revenue to local governments in order to diversify revenue sources for both the state and local government. That also, there was a proposal to reduce or eliminate property taxes in favor of a sales tax or gross receipts tax. And finally, there was a proposal to combine the property tax circuit breaker with a sales tax or income tax increase. And for those of you who don't know, a circuit breaker is an exemption of the first amount of a property tax. So it could be the first $100,000 of a home is exempt from property tax. There are a number of these measures, as I mentioned, under consideration in the 2013 session, including a constitutional amendment to allow voters to approve local tax levies outside the limits of Measure 5. So this would allow a new local option tax, and that reset, as I mentioned, to real market value at the time of sale of property has also been proposed. Also, there is a statutory change proposed to allow maximum assessed value to grow at 3% annually when market value falls below that maximum assessed value. We would assume that more properties are in that situation, so this would be pertinent to them. Right now, their maximum assessed value stays constant as if real market value falls below it and does not grow in those years. This would change that. And there's also opening for any other well-thought-out options brought to the committee to change property tax. So with that, we have Chris Fick with the League of Oregon Cities, Craig Fenneman with the mayor of Sweet Home, Morgan Allen with the Oregon School Boards Association, Maureen Wolf with the Tigard-Tualatin School District, and David Williams with Portland Public Schools, here today to talk about property tax reform and the proposals that are coming up for this session.
Thank you, Christine. Well, and welcome. You've already gotten placed. So why don't you introduce yourself and go ahead.
Good morning, Vice Chair Telfer, Senator Close. Chris Fick with the League of Oregon Cities. Thank you for the opportunity to talk to you today about two constitutional referrals that the League and Association of Groups are going to be pursuing in the 2013 session. These two referrals would seek to ask voters to change our current property tax system. What we're envisioning for this work session are these series of panels. Myself, Mayor Fenteman, will talk about the two proposals. Be happy to answer any questions as they arise, or at the end, then we're going to have a panel of education folks come up and talk to you about what it would mean in their communities and their communities' needs for these two reforms, and then they can answer any questions that you guys have on the education side or otherwise. So before I launch into what our two reforms are, I just want to point out the obvious. Cities like schools, counties, and the state are struggling right now. Overall revenues are down. In the analysis that we've done, cities have depleted their rainy day funds by about 11%. Property taxes, previously the most stable and for most cities the largest source of revenue, have declined. 49 cities saw property tax revenues decrease last fiscal year. We expect that number to go up considerably in this coming fiscal year. Cities like Redmond have seen property tax revenues plummet by 30%. The city of Lebanon has seen its city budget shrink by 28% and saw compression worse than 440% in a single year. Cities from Eugene to Myrtle Creek to LeGrand have also seen property tax revenues plummet. Cities are struggling to figure out how to address this budget situation. We reduced infrastructure spending and deferred maintenance. What we've also done is reduced staff considerably. The city of Portland is downsized by 270 employees. Salem and Eugene have respectively downsized their staff by 110, Bend by 60. Cities are definitely making efforts to come into grips with this new budgetary reality. Cities are also requiring their employees contribute more to their health care plans, and we're working to become more efficient and innovative. Eugene and Springfield, for example, are merging their fire departments, and Salem is consolidating a number of departments under one roof. But truth be told, there are limits to what cities can do with fewer resources. As a result of these conditions, our members are pretty pessimistic about their ability to meet citizen demands in the future or even maintain current service levels. According to our annual survey data, over 90% of our members expect to be in the same or in worse financial situation in the next fiscal year. While we're struggling with our financial situation, we're not asking for additional funds from the state. What we're instead pursuing is an increased, enhanced ability to ask local voters to support local services through a local option levy and to improve the fairness of the property tax system. And with that, I'll go into some more details about the reforms that we're seeking. So the first referral that the League is pursuing would be a modification to Measure 50. Measure 50, as you will recall, was passed in 1990. It capped property taxes for general governments at $10 per $1,000 of a home's real market value, and for schools at $5 per $1,000 for a home's real market value. So for a $200,000 home, there would be a limit for general governments to tax no more than $2,000 and for schools to tax no more than $1,000. Because Measure 5 limits are tied to real market values, it mimics the real estate market, and the limits do not include capital bond measures. If property taxes exceed those limitations, the $10 for general governments, which are school, counties, and special districts, or I'm sorry, cities, counties, and special districts, or the $5 limitations for schools, the amount reduced to bring taxes in line with those limitations is called compression, a process called compression. And under the hierarchy of compression, the first thing that's reduced all the way down to zero are voter-approved temporary local option levies. More than half of Oregon cities are in compression, over 90% of school districts in all Oregon counties. And as you'll see in a couple slides, revenue loss to compression is increasing dramatically. This is an example of what compression would look like for a single household. A home in 2009 had a real market value of $200,000. On the general government side, that means that they are limited to taxing no more than $2,000. In this fictional example, we assume that there's a local option levy of $50, special district collects $500, city $650, and the county $800. Over the course of the next 3 years, the real market value falls by 10%, so the estimated real market value is now $180,000. So the Measure 5 limits for general governments are $1,800. You'll see the first thing that goes all the way down to zero is that property's contribution for the local option levy that voters supported. That goes all the way down to zero, so that property is not contributing for that service. And then the permanent rates for the special district, the city, and the county are reduced proportionally. If you magnify these types of losses over dozens, hundreds, or thousands of properties, you can see how it could wreak havoc on local option levies and general funds. This is a graph showing compression losses for cities, schools, and counties since Measure 5 was passed. You see that schools in particular, compression loss since 08-09 has increased 216%. For cities, it's 161%, and for counties, it's 154%. We expect this picture to get worse when the property tax statistics are released later next year. This is a list of local option levies. These are voter-approved local option levies in communities throughout the state that are losing the most revenue to compression. So the Morrow County School District has a levy. It calculated tax for that levy would be about $1.4 million, but compression losses amount to over $1 million. So the amount the district collects is $400,000. And you see that cities, counties, school districts are oftentimes losing a quarter, a third, half, two-thirds, and in some cases almost three-fourths of the taxes that their voters approved for local services due to Measure 5 limitations. So we have three major problems with the way that this hierarchy of compression works so far. And I'm going to let the mayor of Sweet Home talk quite a bit more about how it affects his community, as well as representatives that you'll hear from the next panel from Tiger Tualatin, Portland, and Beaverton. But suffice it to say that voters for local option levies are voting to increase their own taxes for specific services, but statewide limitations prevent them from being able to pay for those services, and their communities therefore can't provide the services that ostensibly voters want. This fosters a belief in bad government. Voters often say, if you're making budgetary cuts, it's something that they have approved. Look, we voted to raise our own taxes to pay for this service, and now you're telling us you can't provide it. A good example is the Multnomah County Library levy, which passed in May with 84% of the vote. But because of compression losses, the library was forced to close on Mondays and reduce hours other days. And there was an article from the Oregonian about the first time an individual who voted in support of the levy showed up on a Monday to access the library and found out that it was closed. And the quote is, "So terribly disappointed that what we voted for apparently wasn't," end quote. There's a disconnect between voters wanting to pay for additional services and being prevented from doing so by these statewide limits. The second major problem we have are the fact that general governments, cities, counties, and special districts are all lumped together in the same category. So we have a $10 pie. But the effects of any one of these districts, overlapping districts, can have an effect on another. So if anyone goes out for a larger slice of the pie, or if there is a new entrant in the form of a special district, it reduces what other governments can provide. And there's a whole host of examples of places where we've seen this play out, and voters in one community are inadvertently hurting members in another. So Sweet Home and Albany, for example, in Linn County, both have public safety levies to support their police services. Linn County similarly has a public safety levy. If the cities were to go out and ask for a larger local option levy, they would in turn harm the county and vice versa. In Madras, the pool district pursued a local option levy this November for operating expenses for its pool, which is an important part of the community. Had that measure passed, it would have cost Jefferson County money from its local option levy for its jail service. In Deschutes County, there was talk of changing the 911 district's permanent rate, which in turn would have worsened compression in the city of Redmond. So there's a whole host of examples in which communities may be inadvertently harming the services provided in others because we're all lumped together in the same category. The third problem is one that the Oregonian editorialized in late July. It pointed out that properties that are in compression, their owners can ostensibly vote for additional services through a local option levy, but not have to pay for those services. Now, while the Oregonian recognizes that not many people know if their properties are in compression, it is an issue that resonates with voters who think that if voters are going to vote for an additional service and approve levies on other property owners, everybody should pay their fair share for those services. In the example that the Oregonian gave in Portland for a county levy, a quarter of property owners, homeowners, don't pay the full freight for the levy, and a third don't pay anything at all. I think I got those confused. A quarter don't pay anything at all. A third don't pay full freight. So the solution that we're going to be seeking is a referral that would empower local voters to pass local option levies outside of compression. This would not be retroactive. No current existing levies would be outside of compression, so no one would see a tax increase. But communities would be given the opportunity to pass levies to provide some budgetary certainty, be it for their school districts, for their police services, their libraries, or their parks, regardless of what happens to their home's real market values. It would be explicitly stated on the measure, and voters would have the opportunity to pass that levy for 5 years, maintaining the limited duration of the existing levies. We think this is an important tool for communities to have in their toolbox, and we hope to have your support. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions on this first referral.
Thank you, Chris. Any questions? Mayor Fendelman?
Good morning, Vice Chair Telfer and other members of the committee. My name is Craig Fendelman, and I'm the mayor of Sweet Home. I've served on the city council since 1988 and have been elected to the post of mayor six times. Sweet Home is a city of 9,000 in Linn County, and our city, unfortunately, has a particularly low permanent property tax rate. By measure 50 for a city of our size, our permanent rate is $1.42 per $1,000 of value, of assessed value. Just to put that in perspective, among cities of a similar size, Sandy has a permanent rate of $4.12, Cottage Grove has a rate of $7.20, and Astoria a rate of $7.55. As a result of our low permanent rate, our city has been highly reliant on voter-approved temporary levies to fund the police and library services. With a rate as low as ours, we cannot fund our police department or our library system from our permanent rate alone. Our residents have recognized this and have approved temporary levies for our services dating back to 1986. Voters most recently approved our police and library levies in 2010 for 60% and 55% of the vote, respectively. But market values in our community have fallen, and compression of our local option levies went from about 13% of collections, or about $300,000, to 31%, or over $730,000. With those losses, we are not able to maintain the level of police and library services that the voters expected when they voted for the levy taxes on themselves. We've been forced to largely drain our rainy day fund to backfill police and library departments, putting the city in a difficult financial position moving forward. But we also had to reduce services. We cutting library hours and police positions. And we have not had we not used our reserves, the service in the positions would have been much more severe. Moving forward, we will not be able to fund these core services with our reserve funds. Sweet Home, in many ways, is a poster child for why we need to improve our property tax system. Measure 50 unfairly gave us a low permanent rate, and Measure 5 limits worsen our plight even when the voters approve additional taxes. But our situation isn't all that unique. Our fellow cities in Lebanon, Linn County, Albany, Lebanon, all have seen compression losses double over the past few years. Other cities have seen similar increases. And you'll hear from school districts later that are similarly in the same position that we are. Truth be told, I don't know if the voters would approve a levy outside of statewide limitations. Doing so would ensure that we provide the same level of service for library and police that the community has grown to expect, you know, regardless of what happens to the local real estate market. And it would give us budget stability, which is one of the biggest things that we face in this time, is trying to have a stable budget to, you know, fund our services, but and help us retain our police officers, who understandably are worried about their, you know, their uncertainty, you know, uncertain funding levels. But I don't know if the voters will vote for it, but I think they should be given the opportunity. And we should be given the opportunity to ask them if they want this level of service and give us the approval to vote for, you know, vote for the levies and assess the levies. So I would urge your support for the voter control referral, which would allow local communities to determine the level of services that they need. And thank you for the opportunity to testify today.
Thank you. Yes.
Thank you. Mayor Fentiman, can you just, I know that Sweet Home has been very dependent on the timber industry, mm-hmm. and the loss of the timber industry, I would assume, has affected your city revenues, particularly the loss of Willamette Industries. Would you just say a word about how that has affected Sweet Home?
As far as the timber?
Yeah, the loss of that major employer.
Well, basically, when you lose your probably your largest employer at that time, that's hurt us as far as, you know, employable jobs in the community. We're a lot of efforts going right now into economic development. We've got a full-time economic development coordinator trying to rebuild those types of jobs coming in. We've, of course, the Oregon Jamboree, everybody's pretty much aware of that festival to help bring people into Sweet Home. The development of the Foster Lake Marina has been developed, and we're currently working with the county. But the timber industry did hurt, but we realized that we had to do something different and begin doing things differently. The problem is we would love to bring, you know, to bring industry in, to try to get small businesses in. The problem is that if you don't have police services, you're going to have trouble getting anybody to come to town. And that's where we'd like to.
Thank you. I spent numerous years on the Bend City Council, and those were years of massive increase in building, housing, you know, the tax revenue. And even then, I think we were struggling sometimes to make budget. So I can't imagine what they're going through right now. I'm glad I'm not on the city council right now. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yes, Chris.
If I can I go through the second referral briefly?
Sure.
Okay. Sorry.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, it's okay. So the second referral that the legal be seeking would be a change to Measure 50. Measure 50, as you'll recall, created a new assessed value based on 1995 market values minus 10%. It then capped annual growth in that assessed value at 3% annually. So you see in the graph on the wall, the dotted red line shows the housing bubble and the more rapid appreciation of properties, and the lower blue line shows the 3% annual growth in assessed value. The third thing that Measure 50 did was establish permanent rates for all taxing districts, requiring additional requests for additional revenue to go through voter-approved levies. So by locking in assessed value based on 1995 market values, we've seen huge disparities in tax bills emerge as properties have appreciated or depreciated at different rates. So here's an example from two neighborhoods in Portland. The established neighborhood in the mid-1990s, homes in the area were valued at around $135,000. With 3% growth in assessed value, their assessed value now is between $210,000 and $250,000, and their taxes are between $42,000 and $4,900. The gentrifying neighborhood in Northeast 16th, in the mid-1990s, properties could be purchased there for $35,000. This is what's now the Alberta Arts District. But in the 15 years since Measure 50's passage, these property values have increased 5, 6, 7-fold. Yet the assessed value is still pegged to those properties' 1995 real market values. And with 3% annual growth, they're now only between $50,000 and $80,000. Despite nearly identical real market values in these properties, the tax bills that folks in the gentrifying neighborhood pay are a fourth to a third of what folks across town pay for identical services. So people receive dramatically different benefits from the way Measure 50 calculates taxes. This was a graph that Tualatin Valley Fire and Rescue put together and that this committee had a chance to look at back in at a September hearing. It shows the ratio of assessed value to real market value for homes in Multnomah County. So the folks that are in blue are receiving a property tax discount of 50 to 99% as a result of Measure 50. Folks in teal, green, yellow, orange, and red are receiving less of a discount, with folks in red being taxed at approximately 100% of their property's real market value. So you can see that wide swaths of the city are going to enjoy tax breaks, substantial tax breaks, irregardless of how their property values change. And the way in which our system works right now, these are permanent tax breaks that will be forever be subsidized by other property owners in the city. These inequities aren't confined to the Portland metropolitan area. We work with the Deschutes County Assessor to get some examples from Sisters, Redmond, and Bend. And then the Legislative Revenue Office did a study in 2010 that looked at the inequities, horizontal inequities as they're called, in Deschutes, in Multnomah County, but also in Jackson and Sherman, and found that inequities in taxes as a result of Measure 50 were very pervasive everywhere. Oregon has a unique detachment to real market value in that the other states that have assessed value limitations similar to ours, there are now 17 states that do. 15 of those 17 other states recalibrate at the time of sale. So they use the sale time, they use it when a property turns over, as a real market-driven indication of a property's value and of a potential owner's ability to pay. And they recalibrate taxes at that time. Oregon and Arizona are the only states that don't have this aspect in their property tax system when they have these artificial assessed values. And this is a quote from the Lincoln Institute of Land Policy. With no periodic recalibration of assessed values to market levels, the Oregon system has gone the farthest of any in breaking the link between property taxes and property values. So our solution is to implement the idea of recalibrating taxes at the time of sale and reset a property's assessed value to real market value at the time of sale or construction to close some of these tax inequities that exist throughout the state.
That it, Chris? Thank you.
That's it.
Any questions of Mr. Fick? And now is that it?
This is it.
That's it?
Thank you for your
Done?
Attention. Yeah.
Thanks. So we have another panel coming forward, I believe.
So, Madam Chair, if it's all right, we have four folks, and there's two chairs. If we could do it, we'll be brief and do a two-by-two, if that's okay with
that
you.
That works. Okay. Please identify yourself.
Okay, thank you. Chair Telfer, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Morgan Allen here on behalf of the Oregon School Boards Association. And our members, our locally elected school board members, are supportive of legislative efforts to undertake a comprehensive review of Oregon's system of funding schools and other vital public services. And I'm sure I don't need to remind the members of this committee of the challenges our schools have faced over the last 3 years. Oregon has one of the shortest school years in the nation. We've laid off, depending on what you read, probably at least 3,000 teachers statewide and dramatically reduced programs. And unfortunately, that is impacting student outcomes. It's starting to be felt at the student level. But our members are encouraged that this committee is undertaking this discussion about our taxation, and we know it's going to take some significant fortitude to talk to your fellow legislators and to talk to the voters of Oregon, but you can count on the support of locally elected school board members as you engage in this conversation. It is our hope that we can come to a larger resolution that can be presented to the voters, but in the meantime, we're supportive of these two measures that Mr. Fick described, because they can be undertaken, they can dramatically improve school funding, and they don't cost the state of Oregon a dime. And of course, those are the local option levy fix and reset at sale. And as Mr. Fick said, right now, because of compression, school districts across Oregon have voter-approved local operating levies that may not provide the intended money for the local schools to ensure that full school year or prevent school closures or prevent further teacher staff layoffs. So our members are also supportive of engaging the voters of Oregon in this conversation and asking the question whether or not communities should be able to decide if and how much they want to pay to support their schools. If Oregonians want to pay for a service they value, our members believe they should be able to do so. And, of course, for our members, if a community chooses to raise money for their schools, we believe the school district should be able to collect the full value of that local option levy. And so today we've got three districts here to talk about examples of what how compression impacts their school districts and impacts their ability to provide an education for their students. And before I turn it over to them, one of the things that we always talk about in education is equity. And so one of the questions we always get is, well, is this equitable? Because isn't this just an issue for the big districts or the property-rich districts or the upper-income districts? And it's absolutely not. Just in 2012, five school districts across Oregon have passed local option levies. And let me just read you the list of communities that have stepped up to increase their own taxes to pay for their schools. Condon, which in central Oregon, northeast Oregon, Hood River County, Klamath Falls, Morrow County, and Sweet Home. So those are the five districts, school districts in Oregon this year that have passed local option levies. So it's not a question of, you know, the Lake Oswego's or the Riverdale's of the world. You have communities all across Oregon that are trying to step up and do right by their schools. But unfortunately, compression has a big impact on the ultimate outcomes of how that funding makes it down to the school level. So with that, I'll turn it over to our panelists. Thank you.
Thank you, Morgan. Good morning, Senator Telfer and Senator Close. My name is Maureen Wolfe, and I'm the chair of the Taggart-Tualatin School Board, and I truly appreciate the opportunity to speak with you this morning. I'm here today to express my support for the constitutional referral to provide voter control for local option levies. My message is simple. The revenue generated from the local option levy is critical to our school success. By maintaining a levy, our district has been able to stabilize our budget at a time when state funding has certainly experienced high degrees of uncertainty. My purpose this morning is threefold: highlight the success of our district through its effective use of our funds, share the financial impact of our continued local option levy, and certainly most important, to ask for your support to give voters control to authorize local option levies outside of compression. The Taggart-Tualatin story is one that's been often highlighted in the Oregonian and honored by our state. While we reflect the state's demographics, our district consistently outperforms against state averages. Our district has been recognized as a statewide model in helping our struggling students through our intervention programs. Both our high schools have been rated outstanding on the statewide report card, and two of our elementary schools are among the 30 schools noted as model. What you might not realize is the level of national recognition our district has earned. In January 2011, the Center for American Progress issued a report establishing a return on educational investment. The report was to spark a national conversation about educational productivity, meaning how much learning a district produced per dollar spent. This also controlled for factors such as cost of living and students in poverty. TTSD was identified as one of the highest returns as we were compared to other districts in our state. Just last week, the National Center on Educational Outcomes identified our school district as one that effectively uses assessments and accountability to increase performance for students with disabilities. Only a handful of districts across the country have been given this recognition. As part of your packet, I've given you a copy of that recent report. So how do these state and national accolades correlate with our local option levy? First, I truly want to acknowledge our district leaders and our staff who have really been essential to our school's success. Our team is simply amazing. However, because we've been able to maintain a more stable funding model, we've been able to retain our programs that help enable our students to achieve at a much greater level. Our first local option was approved in 2000, providing $4.2 million in operating dollars in its first year, fiscal year 2000-2001, and approximately $22.4 million, over the five-year life of the levy. The option was renewed in fall of 2004, generating almost $5 million in its first year and over $35 million in the life of the levy, which was 5 years. In the fall of 2008, our levy was approved for the third time. We told the voters the rate would not exceed a dollar per 1,000 assessed value, and we estimated our collection would be roughly $7 million in the first year, 2010-11, and would collect almost $38 million over the life of the levy. Although we successfully passed our levy, 2009 brought a dramatic reduction in the state's K-12 education funding. Our district reacted swiftly to the budget cuts. We reduced our staff by almost 90 FTE, an 8% reduction in our general fund. Recognizing the global significance of the economic downturn, our district planned for the long-term shortfalls in our funding. In front, in your packet, I included a financial analysis entitled Tigard-Tualatin District Fiscal Challenges. On this, it reflects how our district, if you look in the center, has been able to maintain an ending fund balance over the past several years. However, by 2010, it was clear that compression was on the rise. As you review our local option levy summary, and that's at the top of the chart, it will show that in 2012-13, compression loss is now greater than the actual taxes that we can collect. We will lose almost $5 million to compression while we collect only 3.8. By the end of the school year, our ending fund balance will dramatically be reduced as we are no longer able to manage the losses we've suffered from compression. Since 2008-09, our district has lost over $12.5 million to compression. If we continue to lose $1 million annually, we will collect an estimated $19 million from our current levy as opposed to the anticipated $37.7 million, which our voters had approved. I believe it will be impossible for our district to deliver the level of education expected from Tigard-Tualatin schools, given the losses that we have and we will incur. I am here today to ask for your assistance in allowing voters to determine the level of support given to their schools. Since the tax is temporary, it holds districts accountable in how they spend their community's tax dollars. I come before you to recommend that communities are given the opportunity to fully support their local schools through the effective use of a local option levy. And thank you again for this opportunity.
Well, thank you for taking the time to be with us today. Questions?
thank you for a very complete presentation of the problem.
Yes. Thank you.
Thank you.
So, Morgan, do you have others?
Two briefly. Thank you for your indulgence.
Okay, certainly.
Good morning, Vice Chair Telfer and Senator Close. My name is Karen Cunningham, Beaverton School Board member and board member with the Oregon School Board Association. And joining me is Sarah Smith, my colleague on the Beaverton School Board. And I thank you for the opportunity to testify. Today, we urge you to support the proposal to eliminate compression as it relates to local option levies. As you know, many Oregon school districts have been slashing operating budgets, educational programs, and staff over the last 5 years. The Beaverton School District has reduced budgets by over $142 million. This year alone, Beaverton has reduced $37 million, or 11% of our budget for 2012-13. We're not alone in this predicament. Class sizes in Beaverton are large. It's common to have 35 to 38 students in an elementary classroom, 40 to 50 students in a high school classroom, with some classes over 60. Again, we're not alone in this funding situation. You've heard similar stories from other districts. It's happening all over Oregon. During these difficult times, school districts have been turning to their communities to garner some local control over school funding. The Local Options 1 funding mechanism that districts have used to help maintain student educational programs and school days. Communities have not been content with waiting for things to get better at the state level. However, many school districts in the Portland metro area that have passed local option levies are now failing to raise the revenue voters approve for their local schools. This is due to compression and, of course, the decline in real estate values stemming from the recession. Some homeowners pay nothing, while others may pay a significant increase in property taxes. Compression is figured on a property-by-property basis. Where's the equity here? Here are some recent examples that paint a stark picture of the financial hit associated with the current law and the effects of compression. As you just heard, Tiger Tualatin lost an estimated $4.4 million this year. Hillsborough lost $1 million. Lake Oswego lost $1 million. And I'm sure we'll hear more about Portland Public Schools. The number I have is $25.8 million. Our school board and leadership team are considering a local option in the near or possibly another year out future. Recent estimates showed that a local option levy for Beaverton could generate $10 to $13 million in revenue with compression. If compression were eliminated, the district would receive $23 million in revenue. You can see the difference. The difference would help our district move forward after years of reductions and uncertainty. It's active organizers and advocates who've worked hard to pass various ballot measures over the year, including two local option levies, one which passed in 2003 and one that failed in November 2011 by 1,000 votes. The compression factor is perhaps one of the most difficult for voters to understand and for us to communicate. Just as an aside, we always have provided a calculator that people need to use, having in hand their assessed and real market values to try to figure out what the levy would mean to them. Very different picture from when we're trying to pass a bond measure, which has a definite amount. And as we all know, if voters don't understand an issue, they're not likely to support it. I actually believe this was part of our problem in 2011. We support the proposed changes that would eliminate compression from local option levies. Voters in our communities want to tax themselves to raise extra revenues for their schools. We recently had several parents and community members testify at a school board meeting and say, "Please tax me." It was really hard to look at them and say, "We can't tax you the way that you want us to and we want to." If these changes pass, they'd help school districts raise desperately needed revenue. It'd also provide more predictability as school districts plan budgets and programs. We urge you to support this proposal to amend the Constitution to eliminate compression from local option levies. Please send this to the voters as soon as possible. Oregon students are depending on all of us to come up with solutions to stabilize education funding. Their education can't wait. Thank you.
Thank you, Karen. I think we'll have David present his case and before we have any questions.
Yes, David. Thank you very much, Senator Telfer, Senator Close, David Williams with Portland Public Schools. I won't belabor the points made here to lend support for the measures as presented. We really see these measures as enhancing fairness, rationality, and effectiveness in the current property tax system. They maintain hard caps on permanent collections while reconnecting to value and an ability to pay. They also give local taxpayers a real choice when they're voting on local option levies rather than the false choice they're given now, where you see instances, as Mr. Fick pointed out, where some taxpayers are voting to raise a rate that they will not end up paying. Just to give you a couple of the Portland examples, we, of course, have an economy of scale that dictates our numbers are fairly large, while our percentage, our compression loss is about 35%. That is the equivalent, as pointed out, our estimate for the coming year is about $27.5 million. If you biennialize that and then translate that to what the equivalent of the state school fund is, we're about 8% of the state school fund. In order to make up that loss, you would need to add about $700 million to the state school fund to make up that roughly somewhere under $60 million that our local voters are willing to support the school district with. We think that's a pretty dramatic way for our voters to connect to our district, to add and enhance the program we're able to offer in Portland Public Schools without placing undue burden on the rest of the state. And we think that that's a fair choice that we should be giving voters all over the state. And I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, David. Any questions of Karen or David? I will wait with anticipation on how you clarify compression to the voters. I can tell you, if I had a nickel for every time a constituent of mine called me regarding what they're paying and what they think their house is worth, if I had a nickel, I'd be sitting on a beach somewhere today. But in any case, good luck with. I actually am anxious to see how you do that. Anybody else want to testify in regards to this topic? Thank you again.
Thank you
all of you for giving the time this morning to testify on this matter. We have a 10 o'clock joint meeting, I guess. So we have about 23 minutes. Paul, do we have a nice big break?
Okay.
We will recess until 10 o'clock. I guess do I have to get
We will reconvene the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee and welcome our colleagues from the House Revenue Committee who are here to join us on our informational presentation on Oregon's income tax apportionment policy, which is very timely given the subject of our single session. I don't think this could have been planned better to have the report that Dr. Werner here is going to present to us. So take it away, Paul.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. Paul Werner, Legislative Revenue Office. We have put together several items for you. Our original intent was to review with you a research report that you have there, Taxation in Oregon's Interstate Competitiveness, and that will be part of this discussion. We've reviewed that with our visiting House members as well yesterday. But the topic this morning is a little bit broader, at which apportioning corporate income is a big part of the competitiveness discussion, but to focus on the broader topic of apportionment, how it works, and of course historically how Oregon's made some very critical decisions in this area. And I'll walk through that with you with the numbers and kind of at a high conceptual level. And then I've asked the folks from Department of Revenue, their corporate unit, to talk a little bit about kind of how they actually implement apportioning corporate income for corporations that operate in multiple states. And there's some decisions they have to make, and I think it gives you a good sense of you know how they actually implement the policies that you've enacted. So the first thing, there's a handout there that is entitled the Single Sales Factor Apportionment. And so it's this handout here. And I wanted to walk through that with you just to make sure that the recognize some of the background, and these are issues that have been coming up over the last few days. But a couple of things to highlight about apportionment. One is that it affects corporations that operate in multiple states. So corporations in multiple states are roughly about a third of our corporations. So they're about almost 13,000 of the 32,000 corporate filers we have. But they are 89% of corporate income tax liability. So those apportioned corporations are almost 90% of the total. So the issue becomes, okay, you have a corporation that operates in multiple states. How do we go about determining what portion of their income is taxable in Oregon? One of the decisions that was made in the 1980s that you're familiar with, that the legislature made was to base corporate income on a water's edge principle, meaning that it was corporate income, corporate profits nationally, not internationally. And this, of course, there was a special session of this, and was a decision that limited what the base was for apportioning. So we apportion national income, and then the next issue becomes, well, how are we going to apportion a certain amount to Oregon? What's going to be the basis for that? And if you look through the document I gave you, you can see that, you know, this issue has been around for a while, particularly in the 1950s. There was a lot of concern on the part of corporations that states would operate in a way they would come up with a formula for determining what proportion of corporate income to tax that would favor the states, that would generate more revenue. And there's some discussion around congressional actions in order to restrict what states could do. That never materialized. And one of the things that the states established was the Multi-State Tax Commission in the 1950s, and the Multi-State Tax Commission adopted the Uniform Division of Income for Tax Purposes, the infamous UDTPA. And so this gave some guidelines to corporations. We are part of that pact, and this was mentioned, discussed yesterday in the House Revenue Committee, that we've had some legal issues around that recently, particularly the California, the Gillette case. But what the UDTPA does, and what the Multistate Tax Commission recommended in terms of a formula, was a three-factor formula which was equally weighted. So the three factors were property, payroll, and sales. So the idea is there's no perfect measure for the presence or the connection of a state, of a corporation to a state, so you have to use approximations. So those were the approximations, and without any beforehand reason to believe otherwise, the Multistate Tax Commission recommended that these be equally weighted. So that's the way that Oregon operated source or to apportion income prior to 1991. We had the three factors, so each company would go through and calculate what percentage, and you can see an example here in this summary that in this example there's 40% of the properties in Oregon, 30% of its payroll, 5% of its sales. You add the three up, divide by three, and the average is 25%. That meant that 25% of this corporation's national income would be apportioned back to Oregon. And then we'd apply our, at that time, 6.6% rate, or now our 7.6% rate for corporate income above $10 million. So, and you, of course, there is a significant difference between these factors, and the language that we use in our report is that these factors, property and payroll, are really production factors, production factors, what we call origin factors. In other words, they're based on where the product is produced. And in terms of the sales factor, it's a destination factor, or where the product's consumed. So that, obviously, when you think about it, it's going to make a big difference for corporations. If you produce a lot of your product in Oregon and sell it outside the state, the property and payroll factor is going to tend to raise your amount apportioned to Oregon. If it's on sales only, then it's going to tend to be a smaller amount. For example, if you sell equally to all the states in the country and you produce everything in Oregon, you'd have about 1.5% of your sales in Oregon as our percentage of the national economy. So those, obviously, it's a key decision for corporations. The other thing I'll mention here, it's a big part of our study, is to, when we talk about this, it's important to remember that we're only talking about tangible property. Okay, so in other words, real physical goods. If we talk about services, we use an entirely different apportionment approach, and that is called the cost of performance. The cost of performance is a much more of a origin-based sourcing method, where the amount of the largest proportion of the service is actually performed, that's where the income is apportioned to. So it's an origin-based calculation. So we have intangible goods, we have a sales-based apportionment formula. For services, we don't. We have much more of an origin-based way of apportioning income, which is the cost of performance. So what we've seen in recent years, if you go back to the 1930s, 1937, for example, even before a lot of this stuff really became seen as a major issue, Iowa had 100% sales factor for their apportioning their corporate income. So the sales factor has been around a long time, but states really began shifting toward a more of a sales factor orientation, and the incentive there was to move toward these destination-based taxes, because the destination-based taxes potentially give you, your companies, a competitive advantage in national and international markets. So if you look on the second page here of the handout, you can see formulas in use since as of January 1, 2012. And I haven't counted them up, but, you know, there's been a dramatic increase in the number of states that have a sales factor. And many states have gone to a double-weighted sales factor. And the double weight just simply means that you count whatever portion of your sales by 50% and the other two portions by 25% each. But you can see where the sales factors come into play. California's gotten a lot of publicity around their move to a sales factor. And initially what they did was give companies an election so they could go either sales or double-weighted sales. And you can see where the states are. In Oregon, of course, is one of the sales 100% sales factor. Some states have gone, the proportions vary. You can see Utah is 84% sales, Pennsylvania 90% sales, New Jersey 70%. We've seen this move, starting with a double weighted, moving toward the sales factor. And then if you look at Oregon's progression over time, you can see that we, prior to 1990, had the equally weighted. From 91 to 03, we had the double-weighted. And then in 2001 was when the legislature made the decision to move to an 80% sales factor. And that was the time, and I was here at the time, that was really the time when the legislature really had a thorough debate about this issue. And I've included the in your packet the bill that moved to the 80%, and eventually went to 100% in 2005. But that was not, you know, it was part of other changes. The bill had a number of other factors in it. But House Bill 2281 was approved by conference committee, signed by the governor, and went from a 50% to an 80%, with the exception of corporations that were defined as public utilities under 314.610, which could elect to stay at the three-factor formula. So, and some of the issues you can see there that were talked about are the issues that, you know, you hear now. The primary issue was around the impact of the apportionment formula on investment and economic development. And that, of course, is the issue that you're looking at now in terms of looking at the special session issue was around that for individual companies. We issued a revenue impact at that time. And you can see that the revenue impact is shows a negative revenue impact. And you can see at the bottom is our static revenue impact. And we calculated this by taking the corporate income tax files we had at the time. And then, and it's quite, for us, it was one of our easier technical things to do because we had the three factors. And so we were able to, our Department of Revenue was able to adjust what the tax liability would be under the double-weighted versus under the 80% weighted. So that's how the revenue impact was calculated. And one thing is important to keep in mind about this decision was that many corporations had a tax increase because of it, because they had a bigger sales factor. So anybody that had a larger sales factor was going to have a tax increase. And so that was a phenomenon that occurred at the time. And in fact, one of the things that was interesting to me at the time was that even after we looked at large corporations, those with over $1 billion in sales nationally, there was more corporations that had a tax increase than had a tax decrease. So you actually increased it on more larger corporations than decreased. But those that received the decrease in tax due to the change in the formula had bigger savings by going that route. So, and you can imagine, you know, the bigger companies in Oregon that had the large presence, the large payroll, large property, primarily manufacturers, were the beneficiaries. And, of course, those were the intended beneficiaries of the bill, of the legislation. So what we did, in effect, with a change in the apportionment formula, we changed our corporate tax base. And we changed that corporate tax base to one which was more oriented toward service and sales. Now, I do have a handout for you, and unfortunately, I didn't get this on the web. It's from the Department of Revenue's annual corporate tax returns. I've got a handout that's entitled "Apportioned Returns," and if you look at that, you can see it first of all, it shows you those numbers I mentioned earlier, that 89% of corporate income taxes are apportioned, the liability, 89%. But it also shows you the industry mix. And the biggest change that resulted from this 01 legislation and the follow-up legislation that moved us to 100% sales was the drop in manufacturing. Manufacturing now is 11.4% of our liability. It used to be almost 50%.
Madam Chair?
Representative Ira Brewer.
Thank you. Just a clarifying question. When you're talking about the corporate, apportionment applies to all corporations, but when you're talking about the corporate liability, you're talking about C corporations, not S corps.
Yes.
And when you talk about the percentage of corporations that are actually using a multi-state formula, apportionment factor of some sort, are you talking just about C corps or C and S corps?
Representative Ayer, I'm talking about just C corps.
Just C in this.
Yes.
Thank you.
Yes, and if you look at the data here. In this table, it's C corporation tax returns only.
Yeah, but I'm sorry, I don't have that in front of me, so I didn't see it. Yeah. Thank you.
Okay. So that's the big change, and now where we have a larger percentage of our tax base is in a wholesale, retail, trade, finance and insurance, management companies, enterprises, more service-oriented companies. One of the things that's important to keep in mind about the apportioning of income, and also especially about when we go to a sales factor, which is destination-based, is to recognize that a corporation has to have nexus in the state to be taxed. And there has to be some definition of nexus, meaning there has to be some substantial connection with the state. And this is one of the issues that the corporate division has to deal with, the Department of Revenue, is not only in terms of corporations for Oregon, where they have nexus in Oregon, but also whether they have nexus in another state. A firm in Oregon that's producing in Oregon and it would sell products to another state, if that corporation has nexus in that other state, then that's a sale that counts that other state, not against Oregon. If that company does not have presence in that state or does not have nexus in that state, then it's thrown back to Oregon. And I've asked the corporate folks to talk a little bit about that, too, because that's one of the complexities of the sales factor is that, number one, in order to receive income from a corporation, it has to have some nexus in Oregon. And number two, Oregon companies for Oregon sales are thrown back to Oregon if that company is selling into a state that it does not have nexus in. So with that background, I'd like to go back to our research report, if I could. I'm hoping everybody has we have copies of this there.
Customers have this yesterday.
Okay, this is the report I went through with House members, Senate members, and I have these. And just to highlight a couple of things, maybe, and also what I wanted to do today in this study, because it's relevant for your policy considerations for Friday, is to highlight the importance of the apportionment formula on an industry location a decision, and you can see why it's a significant factor for corporations. So for our Senate members, I'll remind you what our study did. it was essentially it focused on the state and local taxes and why they and their differences for corporate decisions, for expansion and location decisions in different states. And what we did was we looked at studies that had examined that issue very closely, and then ranked the states, compared the states to their attractiveness for investments for particular types of corporate investment. And then we also did some simulations of our own, extending on those studies to look at some Oregon-specific examples and look at Oregon specifically compared to its region. We did this. We got some excellent input from the Oregon Business Association. We had a work group of people that actually did, for corporations, did the state and local calculations for decisions about which state, what were the comparative tax liability differences for different states. And some of our major corporations helped us, including Nike, Precision Cast Parts, Columbia Sportswear, Conway. They gave us some real good input. And we also went to our friends at the Department of Revenue and the Corporate Audit Division. They helped us go through and kind of think through what are the things to look at, and we appreciated that. The findings of the study are on the first page of that study, and I'll just go through those very quickly, and then I want to refer back to some of the calculations around the apportionment formula. The four major findings from the study are, first, Oregon appears to be very competitive within its region, within its western region, for manufacturing, intensive manufacturing, products, for tangible goods. And largely, one of the major factors for this is the use of the sales factor, the single sales apportionment method. So if you're a capital-intensive manufacturing, you locate in Oregon, Oregon's likely to be a relatively small part of your market. You're exporting out to other states. You're going to base your apportionment back to Oregon based on your sales, which is going to be a relatively small component. So you can think of our major manufacturing exporters and realize that they're going to have a relatively small share apportioned back due to that sales factor. So that's one of the key advantages. We looked at two studies, and one gave Oregon an extremely positive rating in terms of low liability, one of the lowest tax liabilities in the country. It was second lowest. This was the council state taxation that you've seen some of their more general business tax studies, but this was on their location decisions. It was primarily because of that sales factor. Under their assumptions, there was no throwback to Oregon, so we had a relatively low corporate income tax on those investments, and we didn't have a sales tax on business inputs, which, remember, are an important business cost. So the second observation goes back to the way we apportion, again, the importance of the apportionment formula. The way that we apportion service companies is different than the way we apportion goods producers. We use the cost of performance measure, which is essentially a source-based way of apportioning, and so the service companies that would be export-oriented, admittedly, they're a lot smaller percentage of the total because most service companies would be domestically-oriented, selling into the state markets. But by going to the cost of performance, the service-based exporters don't get that same advantage that the tangible goods producers do, because they're whatever they produce, if you have an accounting service or marketing service and it's located in Oregon and you're selling all around the country, that cost of performance is going to put those sales in Oregon because that's where they were performed. So, again, we highlight the difference between the two. We went through and made some calculations about what a switch to a market-based approach to services, what effect that would have, and I'll show you that in a minute. It is pretty significant. A number of states have gone in that direction, Utah, for example, California, but it's the exact same decision that the 2001 legislature looked at in terms of manufacturing was, Is this a direction that the state wants to go in terms
Paul,
of...
Paul, if I can stop you right there. For the export-oriented service companies, if you have a large accounting firm, to use your example, in Oregon, and they have an out-of-state office that performs services in another region, maybe, how are those... is that still counted as in the Oregon base?
One of the quirks of the, Madam Chair, one of the quirks of the cost of performance, and are my DOR folks, I could probably give you more of the detail, but one of the quirks is that it's based on whatever state you have the largest proportion of that service performed. So then it's all allocated back to that state. So if you had 40% in Oregon and six other states that were 10% each, it would still be allocated back to Oregon as an Oregon sale.
Hmm. That is a quirk.
Okay. So,
thanks.
So, and for previews for our Senate committee, we do have a legislative concept for after this portion that would move the state to a market-based away from the cost of performance. But there are a number of issues around that that would need further discussion, particularly how you measure market, which is not as straightforward as it sounds. So that's another finding. The other issue, of course, that we have wrestled with in terms of tax policy, especially in terms of tax reform, and I know the Senate committee spent a lot of time on this at our September meeting about kind of the preliminaries of this study, is that when you involve personal income taxes, obviously they're not a direct business tax, but can be a significant factor for individual corporate decisions. Obviously, for pass-through entities, it's a significant factor. Then Oregon's competitive advantage, it's much less so. But obviously, given the significance of the income tax, and you've all seen my chart with the big red bar, if you're going to deal with that, probably involves pretty substantial tax reform. So it's not something that would be obviously adjusted at the margins.
Senator Hess.
Thank you. On that note, Paul, I just kind of want to get your take on that these are two different, that the confirming the single sales and reforming and stabilizing our tax code by lowering income taxes complement each other. They're not fighting with each other.
Senator, absolutely yes. I think as I said, in terms of the sales factor, much of that debate was in 2001. You're dealing with C corporations, you're dealing with, a much smaller scale decision than tax reform, where you're really looking at how you finance the whole public sector. I would say yes, they're very much different issues.
If I could just follow up, I very much want to advocate us doing that sometime in our lifetime, because this is one way you can sync up our tax code to our economy, and lowering those personal income tax rates is the way to do that. Whenever you talk about that, a sales tax rears its ugly head, but when we look at these expenditures, you can see these expenditures add up to twice what that sales tax would bring in. So there's more than one way to skin the cat, but the key here isn't so much a sales tax or how you do it, but lowering those income tax rates to make this state more attractive to the businesses that are here and the ones that may seek it out, while still generating the money to keep schools open.
Thank you, Senator Hass. I think we have a bill for that.
One thing I might add, too, on the topic of tax reform, one of the most recent major tax reforms we've had was in Ohio, in which Ohio eliminated the corporate income tax and went to a gross receipts tax, which they call the commercial activity tax, the CAT. And one of the decisions that they made in terms of the CAT was to make it destination-based. So what that meant was that if you are a producer, and I've talked to some of the companies who have facilities in Ohio that are producing in Ohio and selling outside, for them, those are not counted as sales, or they're not counted as commercial activity in terms of the CAT. But if you're selling products into the state, then it is. So that, again, they made that same decision in terms of what kind of a sourcing rule do we use, and they chose the destination-based sourcing rather than something that was origin-based, very similar to the sales factor decision. The final major finding we had was we did go through and look at some of the incentives that were statewide incentives, but the definition we used were those that were done by the Tax Foundation in their study, which were those that were generally available, not specific ones. And it was interesting because Oregon, Washington, California, Nevada didn't have anything that met that qualification. The only thing they had was R&D credits, which we didn't use in our sample sample firms. But the other states in the mountain zone, Utah, Colorado, Utah and Colorado and Idaho all had some type of general incentives, and what we found was in terms of those regional rankings, it didn't make much difference. So there wasn't a significant difference. So that's important to keep in mind. We're not saying incentives don't make any difference, but these are general ones. And what Oregon has done and what California and Washington, too, is to use more specific type incentives that are tailored towards specific things. For example, enterprise zones are not included in this study because they're not generally available. You have to locate in the enterprise zone. So those types of incentives, the SIP is another good example of that is not generally available because you have to meet some very high criteria. So keep that in mind. So that was the choice that those states have made, not that they don't use incentives. Okay, I'll refer back to my study and go to page 11, which goes through the that makes a reference to the single sales factor in terms of the corporate income tax, and in terms of the council estate taxation, there. Their conclusion that Oregon ranks with the second lowest relative tax burden, a lot of it is based on the single sales factor. In fact, any of these states that have more destination-based sales tend to rank better in these studies. We ranked actually second in the cost study. In the Tax Foundation study, we were near the middle of the pack, and we think the reason for that difference is the fact that the Tax Foundation study put a lot more significance on the throwback rule. Remember I said, if you under the throwback rule, if you're producing in Oregon and you sell to a state you don't have nexus in, then it's thrown back to Oregon. It counts as an Oregon sale. So it can negate that effect. So the issue becomes how much is thrown back to Oregon in general. Well, we looked at the tax returns, and approximately 10% of the sales are thrown back to Oregon. It's important to keep in mind, though, that those companies differ. If you're a large company, and you probably have nexus in just about all the states, and if you do, then you're not going to have much throwback. So that's not going to be an issue for you. If you're a smaller company that exports to several states and have sales in those states, but you don't have any kind of a presence there or not enough to meet nexus requirements, then those sales are thrown back. So there is a disproportionate effect through the throwback rule on those companies that tend to be less active in other states are going to tend to be the ones most affected by the throwback rule. So we developed a series of case studies, and the one that I think is most relevant for our discussion, your discussions you'll have this Friday, Thursday and Friday, for a capital-intensive manufacturing facility. It was one of the case studies we looked at. We had a total property value of $75 million. So you could conveniently double that to 150 for purposes. And we went through and calculated what would be the effective tax rate on investment of that magnitude in Oregon compared to Washington, California, Idaho, Colorado, Utah, and Nevada. And the answer is that if you looked at the the overall tax rate, assuming that we have a 10% throwback, which we said was basically what is the overall average. Oregon has the lowest effective tax rate in the region. So that was our first conclusion we mentioned, is that Oregon is highly competitive in terms of these capital-intensive manufacturing. Now, this can also give you some insight into how a company may look at a state that has a double-weighted sales. And if you think about that company as not having to worry about throwback, in other words, it have presence in a lot of other states and throwback's not an issue for them, the total liability on this investment of $75 million in our example, and some specifics around the company, the total liability would be about $1.4 million for that company. Idaho has a 7.6% corporate tax rate and has a double-weighted sales factor. And our estimate for them is about $2.2 million. And that one of the big reasons for that difference is the corporate income tax. The corporate income tax for in Oregon would be about $226,000, in Idaho about $475,000. So a difference of about $250,000. And this is for a $75 million investment. If you double that to 150, which is, if you've looked at our bill, that's the threshold, that would double that to about 500,000 in terms of that particular example of that investment. I'm not saying this is reflective of any single company, but it gives you a sense of what that difference would be from going from a double-weighted factor to a 100% sales. In that calculation. So I think the significance is that it is an important factor in those kinds of location decisions. So I will finish up with my emphasis on at the very beginning of the study we conducted is these are for corporate location decisions. We're looking at taxes and how taxes differ. And I don't want to ever give you the impression that that's the number one factor that influences location decisions and that corporate locations are the main reason why states grow at different rates. So I'll use my qualifying sentence here that when interpreting results, it's important to keep in mind that taxes are only one of many factors in determining location, and corporate location is only one of many factors that influences state economic growth. So we're trying to narrow down on one specific decision. But it happens, though, that the proposal before you is really addressing that specific kind of decision. So it's not really a broad economic growth decision, but rather a specific one in terms of a corporate location or expansion decision in a state. So I'll ask my Department of Revenue friends, if you have a few minutes to come up and see if there's some things I've misstated.
Thank you, Paul. That was very good. If you all could keep it as short as possible, we have a floor session in the Senate at 11, but we don't want to miss anything.
Okay, thank you, Chair Burdick, members of the committee. Ken Ross from Department of Revenue. I think in light of that, and Paul had asked us to maybe talk a little bit about administrative issues and some of the concepts within the corp tax world like Nexus and keep it at a real high level. We think he did that, and I don't think we're going to correct any misstatements or anything, but we would open it up for questions.
Maybe you could just go a little bit more into Nexus, because that issue does come up, on a pretty regular basis in a number of contexts. So just kind of give us a little primer on how the Nexus process works.
Okay, thanks, Chair Burdick. I'm going to actually turn it over to this person who is our corporation policy analyst.
Welcome. Chair Burdick, members of the committee, I'm Jeff Henderson. I'm the corporate tax policy coordinator at the department. To your question for Nexus, it's really important. It hinges on for sales of tangible personal property. As Paul mentioned, it gets into especially for companies that manufacture tangible products, ship it outside of the state. It gets to the throwback question, whether or not they are taxable in another state, whether they have nexus. And that nexus is just a minimum connection that is required in order to for a state to subject that taxpayer to their tax, as Paul mentioned. So it's big for sales of tangible personal property and for the throwback sale.
But give us some examples of how a nexus would be established.
Okay. Some of the clear guidelines that are set are if there's a clear presence in that state, it could be like having office space, employees in the state. A lot of times that is a clear establisher of nexus, that minimum connection. But there are several. It's a large umbrella. Nexus is a large umbrella, and there's several certain pieces like economic nexus where maybe there's not that physical presence in the state, but there is a minimum connection to other activities that have the courts have found to establish nexus and allow states to impose tax on those corporations. But clearly physical presence in the state clearly establishes nexus for taxpayers.
So if you had, like, in the aerospace industry, like we have our other Fortune 500 company besides Nike is Precision Castparts, and they create parts for the aerospace industry, so nexus would be established in California because of the aerospace industry that buys their products?
Chair Burdick, so it would I guess it would depend on that company's presence in California, mm-hmm. whether or not they have nexus.
Not just based on sales.
It is not just based on sales. That's correct. Not simply based on sales. So they would have to have a connection with California in order to have nexus.
So they'd have to have an office there.
That would be a clear indication of nexus.
I'm trying to get at what other things besides an office. Paul, do you know?
Salesforce.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there could be a Salesforce. There could be subsidiaries, for example, finance arm or something of a company. Those kind of things that may come into play.
Right. Yeah, and
I will say, Madam Chair, and I know that the department has to deal with it. There are definitely some vague areas, and there's evolving concept of what does constitute equity. And I think you've had some bills over the years to try to define some of that, but it's not always clear where those guidelines are.
Yeah, it was very, very confusing the one time we did deal with it. That's why I was trying to put you on the spot here. Okay, Jenny. Chair Barnhart.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The question that's more interesting to me, it would be an example that might involve a state like Washington that doesn't have an income tax. A company in Oregon that sells into Washington does not have nexus. The sale is thrown back to Oregon for tax purposes. I think I understand that correctly. What happens if they do have nexus in Washington, but Washington doesn't have an income tax? Does it still throw back or not?
Yeah, Chair Burdick and Representative Barnhart, that is specifically addressed by rule. The B&O tax is considered an income tax for purposes of determining whether or not taxable. So
okay.
The regulations do address that, and they would be considered taxable in Washington, so there would be no throwback.
Okay, and let me, if I could follow up. Maybe I've chosen the wrong state. Let's pick state XYZ that doesn't have a B&O tax and doesn't have an income tax. What's the rule then? I'm talking about throwback in a case in which there is nexus in XYZ state. But the company is located in Oregon and manufactured in Oregon. Does the throwback rule apply because there's no actual tax attached to the sale in XYZ state, or does the throwback not apply?
Chair Burdick and Representative Barnhart, the statute does, or the code goes into to describe what constitutes taxable, what types of taxes would make this company taxable in the other state. And in a situation like if it were Nevada where there wasn't a corporate income tax, they wouldn't be taxable. And so those sales shipped to Nevada would be thrown back to Oregon and considered an Oregon sale.
Okay, so if I could follow up, So in that very specific case, the fact that there's nexus in Nevada doesn't matter. The sale still throws back to Oregon.
No, I think it's that the sale can't throw back unless there's nexus. Is that correct?
Representative Barnhart, they wouldn't be subject to tax in Nevada, and so the throwback sales gets to that. If they're not taxable in another state, not taxable in Nevada, it does get thrown back. So the fact that they have office space in Nevada, have employees in Nevada, would be subject if there was a tax. They wouldn't be taxable.
But if there's no nexus, then it wouldn't be thrown back. Is that correct?
If there's no nexus, the throwback does come into play, and the sale does get thrown back to Oregon.
If there's no nexus.
There's no nexus.
Just because there's no tax.
If I could follow up, because
one more time.
Yeah. I think what you've just told us is that the question is whether the other state gets to tax that sale or not. If they do tax that sale, then there's no throwback. If they don't tax that sale, then there is throwback.
Chair Burdick and Representative Barnhart, it does. This comes back to sourcing issues. This kind of goes to the framework of corporate tax and UDIPA from the 60s. It talks about how that sale is sourced, whether it be sourced, thrown back, and sourced to Oregon or sourced to that other state. And if taxable in that other state, then it would be considered a sale to that other state. So the income stays in the base, but we're talking about how the sale gets sourced for apportionment purposes.
So nexus is only one of the factors. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Appreciate
it. Complicated. Senator Telfer.
And I know we have to go, so I'll make this quick. As a CPA, we're dealing with this more and more every day, where states are overreaching and trying to get to not only our own accounting practices, because we happen to have a tax return that ends up in another state, but
especially
they really are trying to grab taxes, and it's really a very gray area. And so you had mentioned that, is there a possibility that Oregon and other states are really going to have to start to tighten this up? There's a lot of gray area, and a lot of states are trying to take advantage of that and overstep its bound. And, we're spending a lot of time trying to defend our clients from something that this other state should not be reaching into Oregon to try to get. I guess we're looking for the Department of Revenue to kind of help out with some sort of more concrete ruling.
Okay, we'll leave it there.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question to bring up HealthNet, not in relation to what's coming before us on Friday. So the HealthNet decision, if I understand under UDIPA, we're saying if the HealthNet decision is found in taxpayer tax to be in favor of the taxpayer, then we fall back on UDIPA. And did I hear correctly yesterday that under UDIPA, it's the three-factor formula, or they can choose a sales factor? So is that true that I heard that that's they can choose then? We fall back to that. If they do that then for the state of Oregon's budgeting purposes, then it strikes me, and specifically because you mentioned that there were quite a few corporations whose liability actually increased when they went to single sales factor, that they now can file protective claims. And they probably should, as practitioners, we'd be advising those C corporations to file protective claims under the three-factor formula. Have we quantified our exposure, or are you waiting till we get to some kind of legal set, some decision level of court case?
Yeah, you want me. Chair Burdick, Representative Ayer, we have put, it's a big fuzzy number, but we have looked at that and the exposure, roughly $100 million, and we have been advising tax preparers or corporations to file protective claims to preserve their right to amend if that should come up.
All right. We have reached the end of our time period, and I want to thank my House colleagues for joining us. It was probably repetitive for some of it, but it was good to have you here with us. So thank you. We will pause for a moment.
Are we pausing or are we
We're pausing for 1 minute to allow transition. And then
the girls go off.
We will come back from our pause for the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee. And now our next order of business is to open a work session, which we will do for the purpose of committee bill introduction. And committee members, you all know that we are not making judgments on the merits or demerits of any of these bills. These are concepts that have been either developed by the committee or presented to the committee for introduction, and they will have to fly with their own wings or not when the legislature comes into session. We are simply getting them into the process without judgment on their merits. So, Senator Telfer, Mazin, did you want to say anything about this before we get a motion? Or Paul? No. We're going to be very
the less the
today.
Better.
The yes. less the better. Senator Telfer, do you have a motion?
Madam Chair, I move the following LC drafts to be introduced as committee bills for pre-session filing for the 2013 session. LC 0196, LC 0254, LC 0968-1, LC 1330, LC 1331, LC 1332, LC 1333, LC 1334, LC 1335, LC 1336, LC 1337, LC 1338, LC 1339, LC 1340, LC 1341, LC 1383, LC 1502, LC 1699, LC 1701, LC 1702, LC 1703, LC 1704, LC 1705, LC 1706, LC 1707, LC 1708, LC 1709, LC 1711, LC 1712, LC 1713, LC 1714.
Okay, Senator Telfer has moved the aforementioned legislative concepts to be introduced as committee bills. We have there were a couple of late arrivals, but most of the relating clauses are presented here for you on your agenda. So, is there any discussion on the motion? Did I do it okay, Paul? Is there any objection to the motion? So ordered. These will be introduced as committee bills. We are finishing 3 minutes early. And is there any other business, Paul, that we need? Again, I want to welcome our new member and our new vice chair. And we are adjourned.